or actually these are reductions that might have been taken back during the Great Recession that were then added back through subsequent budget decisions. And finally, ongoing infrastructure spending at about $6.3 million. Any questions on that before?
I guess I'm just kind of curious. I mean, I know you go to the Government Finance Officers Association conferences all the time, so how does this fingerprint compare with other cities?
So we are we're significantly better than other cities, and Josh Harwood had a slide that we included last in the council work session last October that sort of showed, looking at the National League of Cities data, which looks at a whole bunch of cities nationwide, across the country, cities are just getting back to their pre-recession levels of general fund. Whereas Portland has been on a steady upward path, we recovered and have greatly exceeded where we were before the recession. So, and there's a lot of factors to that. We know that this is a very high demand city with a lot of people moving here, but we have done better than other cities.
Okay, thanks.
So moving on then from ongoing. I wanted to talk just briefly about one time, and this is, you know, a different side, of the equation. We have made over the same time period of this last 4 years some really important and fiscally responsible decisions, with these one-time revenues. It's pretty remarkable to me, though, when we look at the total, it's $160 million of excess one-time that was invested during this time period. And what this chart reflects is where that one-time has been spent. And you can see that just, programmatic carryovers, these are things council approves in the bump. There's been some technology investments, which is good. Infrastructure investments of almost $50 million. This is just through 2017-18. That number is going to grow quite a bit as part of this 18-19 budget process as well. Significant investments there. But then still almost $83 million of what we just termed as other ads, because it was hard to really categorize these. You have a table there, inlaid table within this chart that shows what some of those are. This gets to about three-quarters of that $83 million. Housing and homelessness, by far the largest amount, $34 million of one-time has been invested there over the last 4 years. Special appropriations was just a little over $10 million of one-time. Transportation's got a large chunk at $5 million, police at $4.4 million, ONI, the General Fund Reserve. General Fund Reserve, by the way, is an automatic thing. We have a financial policy that keeps our General Fund Reserve at 10%. So when the General Fund grows significantly, we have to make investments to keep that at 10%. So that's automatically done as part of the forecast, but an additional $3.3 million there. Youth Bus Pass and PDC Prosper. Everything below that, though, there's still, roughly $20 million not included in this chart, and it really is very small, $1 million things, a few hundred thousand dollars here, a few hundred thousand dollars there. I think what I wanted to highlight most with this chart was just that these investments can be really meaningful, and I think we see that on infrastructure and technology, and we see it, in housing and homelessness dealing with some of the crisis. But when we invest our one-time funding in programs, it often does create the future expectation that funding will be there. And so, it creates that pressure on council and the city to find the ongoing resources as those one-time programs end every year. And that can squeeze some of our other ongoing priorities in the city. Any questions on one-time spending? So those were the context slides. And now I'm going to, just to remind us where we've been in the last 4 years, I'm going to move on now to some of the future strategy issues and things that I think we should would be good for the city to talk about that might, again, begin to reframe a little bit the decisions we make and think about the long-term consequences of those decisions. So in terms of future strategies, one of the first questions is, how do we manage the programmatic expenditure growth? And again, as I mentioned, there have been a lot of new programs added. There's been a lot of one-time funding added. One potential strategy to address this risk posed by the one-time programmatic investments is to require that all one-time decision packages include a plan that details how and precisely when the program will transition off of general fund resources. This is something that we don't really ask our bureaus to do now. They come forward with one-time requests. One-time, by definition, on our financial policies, has to be spent on short-term, temporary pilot projects. But we know from a lot of bureaus that they really are making these requests with the intent of coming back and asking for ongoing in the future. One thing we could do is require bureaus, if they're making a one-time request, to talk about how the program will end. How will it be phased out? How will the people being served by the program be notified? How will the staff be laid off? How will we essentially sunset that program? I think it really would require bureaus to think through that issue, and it would require council as they look at funding one time to ask that question. Is it truly a pilot project? Is it truly a one-time expenditure that will go away? Or is there an expectation here for more in the future? Additionally, I think a second strategy that would allow council to assess the value and benefit of some of our new ongoing programs in relation to other city priorities is to require that new programs be reviewed by council and reauthorized after a period of time. We threw 3 years on here, but it could be 2 years, it could be 4 or 5 years. This is something that really it's very common in state government, and it's very common at the federal level that programs have to be reauthorized periodically. And I think this is something the city can discuss. It could be done for all programs coming back on a 3, 4, 5 year cycle. It could also just be done for new programs, right? That if we're establishing a new program, what were the intended goals of it? What were the intended outcomes? And have that program come back to council after a period of time and report back on whether they achieved those things. But this would, again, it gives council an opportunity to review that and really compare that program to some of the other priorities that may have come up in the meantime to decide if it's where we want to continue reallocating our resources. Finally, another strategy to ensure the city can continue to plan and responsibly address our large financial risks involves coordination between bureaus about what those large enterprise risks are. This is something that Chief Administrative Officer Reinhardt has. It's one of his top priorities for this year. He's already begun convening people in terms of taking this enterprise risk management look. And Tom, I don't know if you want to speak a little bit to that effort.
Thanks, Andrew. Yes, I have been gathering the leaders at this table here, the CFO, the budget director, myself, the city attorney, and the Bureau of Human Resources director. It's a very common practice in most cities across the country, and that is to catalog significant enterprise risks, to score them, and to manage them with council regularly so that not just in budget decision when you're making decisions on a policy level, but throughout the year you can see how we're doing. One specific example from last week, I gathered some leaders from various bureaus that are all involved in thinking through the future of how we work together on the Superfund Portland Harbor cleanup. We need to be doing this regularly as this legacy liability really needs to be handled and allocated over in the next several years. And really, there has not been a place where that is standard. There have been good leaders leading on that individually. But what we are trying to do is institute a regular practice that you as council can count on and that you're seeing the scores from us of how we're doing so that it informs your decisions. And I'm very excited that people have been interested in this and have been putting their shoulder to it. And I'm going to be visiting at least one other city to research their own process.
Questions from council about the programmatic expenditures and potential strategies there?
So the council could do any of these things at any time. Are you proposing more of a consistent policy? Are you proposing a charter reform? What are you proposing? Or are you just supposing this?
We sort of brainstormed on what some ideas are. We want to put those ideas on the table and really just get the reaction from council about which of those you want us to move forward with. You're right, council, these particular ideas, again, Tom's already moving forward on enterprise risks. I think that's taken care of. The reauthorization of new programs is a decision council could take at any time. You could do it on a citywide basis, or you could do it on a very specific program-by-program basis. And so we certainly could draft financial policies that deal with reauthorization. It's also something council could do on a piecemeal basis. And then in terms of the one-time decision packages, that is something, again, it could be incorporated into financial plans. It could also just be part of our normal budget process that as we review these one-time expenditures that we ask these questions about the phase-out of that program.
Commissioner Fritz?
Have you looked at whether one-time things that are asked for in bumps are more likely to become ongoing than one-time things that are in the actual budget?
It's a good question, and I haven't looked at that specifically. We certainly could go back and separate out one-time funding that's in the budget versus a bump process to see what happens to it.
Yeah, I think the clarity is part of what I'm interested in. I mean, there are some things that you're just trying, and there's others that, well, we're just getting in the bump. We don't have ongoing money in the bump, but people can be clear that they are going to ask for it in the budget. But then how that then plays out when you've got somebody in the position and it's that versus something that a bureau wants to do. So I think it would be interesting to do that analysis.
Okay. So while some of these sound great, like requiring one-time decision packages to include a plan to transition off general fund resources, I know what the answer to that question is 90% of the time, which is we will show you that it is so valuable and so important that you will prioritize it in your next budget. I mean, I don't know how many times I've heard that. There are some things that we do that I believe are truly one-time packages, so we're not really talking about those. Like if we're paying down a debt stream or something like that, that's sort of a no-brainer. It's the ones where we are funding something that is seen as an urgent community priority that's important, or it's brought to the city council, and people say, will you support this? And they make a good case, and we agree with that case. I always feel like it's important for us to put the disclaimer on the table that this is not a permanent arrangement.
I think those things can actually exist at the same time. So a bureau can come forward and say, look, this is a pilot project. We hope to prove its worth. I think having a plan would include two things. It would be, at what point does the bureau come back to council and show the results of the program? So really saying, like, that's going to happen.
So that and I agree. So I think sort of bullet point number one isn't really that productive. Bullet point number two gets towards more of a strategy, and it's more consistent with what foundations do when they give resources to a nonprofit or to a community organization. They say, okay, we hear your top line message, we hear your narrative, we agree with the need and the demand for what it is you're proposing, we agree with the leadership team you have in place that they're capable of pulling it off. Go out and prosper and come back in 2 years and tell us what you did with it. We could formalize that part of the process. I'd like to believe we are that rigorous, and I know, for example, through the Children's Fund, that's already built into the structure of the program, and it seems to work very effectively.
Right.
And maybe there are ways we could strengthen the way we do this through policy.
Yes.
So I'm more attracted to the number two and number three than I am number one.
Okay.
I just feel like I know what the answer is going to be on number one, so why waste the paper?
Well, and the other thing about that is the biggest of the one-time packages is the houselessness work in the Joint Office of Homeless Services. And basically we're one-time funding that because we hope at some point it's not going to be ongoing, and also because we just don't have that amount of money in the ongoing that's available.
Yeah, and I agree with that 100%. And frankly, of all of the line items in our budget that I'm the most concerned about, that's it. I mean, when I look at LA and their expenditure rate and how quickly they've gotten to $1.5 billion level of expenditure, I don't think anybody here thinks the homeless situation is going to go away anytime soon. So we have to really start thinking about how do we integrate this into the responsibilities that we have with finite resources. And we have not come up with a good solution to do that.
Agreed. I was just going to say that, you know, when I think about this, there's a lot of core services that the city offers that are we do not anticipate are going to change anytime in our lifetimes. I just wonder, by limiting yourself to just new programs, if there aren't things that the city does that maybe you need to do less of over the course of time that are not necessarily new programs, but maybe a fruitful way to, and I know that that's part of what the whole 5% cuts exercise is about, is having bureaus look internally and try and make decisions about where they could do some scaling. But I wonder about just limiting it to new programs, if there might be some existing programs that might be warrant that kind of scrutiny.
So I think that's a great point. And, you know, in addition to this, there are other things going on. You know, the 5% somewhat gets at that. But one of the things the mayor asked us to do this year is start a deep dive process. And the first bureaus we are doing that for is transportation and housing. And the goal is to really take the more comprehensive look at those bureau budgets. And I think depending on how this year's deep dive goes, the mayor has, you know, said this may be something he wants to do for all city bureaus in the future. And there are other, you know, there are other tools as well. You know, a few years back we did a 90-10, you know, budget exercise during the Great Recession, which got at some of those programs. There's, you know, zero-based budgeting, there's modified zero-based budgeting, and, you know, program offers that the county does. So there are lots of different tools and techniques that can begin to get at that, but I 100% agree with you. This was really focused on how do we make sure the new things we're adding are achieving the results, but 100% there are things in our core base that we should be reevaluated as well.
Could I add one thing to the list, and maybe it's not appropriate for this particular area, maybe it's really in the capital expenditure bucket as opposed to ongoing programmatic expenditures. But we had, you know, Chief Myers is here, and I appreciate the fact that he has shown up for every one of these sessions. We had a really good conversation the other day about potential reserves throughout all of our bureaus. And we happened to have the conversation at the Fire Bureau because the Chief was here and he was engaging in that conversation. That any one of our bureaus, we could talk about things where you know when something is going to become obsolete and you know it's critical to your delivery of core services, and yet there's no reserving, there's no planning for future investments. And I feel like that needs to be reflected here somewhere as well if we're going to talk about financial sustainability.
Yeah, so we actually have a slide that Jennifer will get
sorry,
to just
I'll
in
stop
a few minutes.
Wait.
So, no, that's a good segue. Let's jump back to the slide deck. So slide number 6, and you've seen all this data before, so I won't belabor this, but just, you know, to remind you, you know, the greatest risk to the city really comes with our future liabilities, and our infrastructure major maintenance backlog is one of those primary liabilities that is facing the city. The average annual funding gap is estimated at $310 million per year for the next 10 years to address both our immediate needs and maintain those current levels of service. We have taken really important measures. We talked about those at the first work session that we had, but I think there's more that can be done. And so I want to dive into some of those future-looking strategies.
what is RRR?
Repair, rehabilitation, and replacement. In terms of current strategies, just as a reminder, you know, the Citywide Asset Managers Group, I think, has become more and more robust over the last few years. These are the asset managers from all the infrastructure bureaus. And, you know, their work and cooperation is really critical to maintaining the city's long-term, financial health, resiliency, and operations of our programs. They've been really helpful in defining the size of the funding gap, which is an important and necessary step, although we're going to talk about how we take the next step on that as well. I think they've really helped with some of the citywide planning with, again, some future things we can do. One of the things, so I want to note, you know, the CAMG, the new revenues, which have totaled over $250 million, if you look at all the different things we've done in terms of the parks bond, the gas tax, Build Portland, housing bond, et cetera. But then the last thing is we do have an existing city financial policy. So this is on the books. It's been there for a long time. That whenever bureaus identify a significant gap between their need to maintain or modernize their capital assets equipment and the funds available for such improvements, the bureau director shall present a strategy for meeting those needs to the city budget office and the commissioner in charge. The practice of this, to be totally frank, has been somewhat inconsistent. I think we can point to the Bureau of Environmental Services and their efforts over the last couple of years to do exactly this, right? They've identified this gap. They've looked at where they are in terms of their overall rate methodology, and they've said, how do we close that gap? How do we put a financial plan in place that closes that gap? But some of our other infrastructure bureaus have really struggled. And so one of the things that we're going to talk about here in the next few slides is what can we do to help these bureaus further define what that is and really begin to put together some of these plans so that whether or not we can fund them, at least we know what the size of the gap is and we're moving towards that solution. Rather than just talking about how big the problem is, we begin talking about what the solution is. So I think step one in that process is really making sure that we have the data to drive the solution. As I noted, over the last decade, our asset managers have done an incredible job of really defining what some of the gap is. But there's another step we need to take, and it involves condition assessment. And what robust condition assessment does, it allows for the more data-informed decision-making to how we invest in our assets rather than just the informed guesswork in terms of where we should spend our money. And it really is a necessary precondition for cost-efficient asset management. As I mentioned, you know, BES not only is putting this financing plan together, but they've really undertaken the system-wide conditions assessment with the intent of developing a long-term capital plan. And I think Jonas Beery is here in case council does have any questions about what BES has been doing in this regard. And then in terms of long-term planning, the plans that the city needs to develop would allow us to invest in our assets that are critical for service delivery and that also have the highest return on investment. The ultimate goal here is to have a long-range capital plan that's optimized for the lowest cost solution to funding our infrastructure gap. So I want to talk, we did some research on other cities, and I just want to talk really briefly about Washington, D.C. They have not always been held up as a prime example of urban government, but I think actually in the last 10 years, they've made some incredible strides in a lot of areas, and infrastructure is one of those. Washington, D.C.'s budget office develops their annual capital budgets, as most budget offices do, but they also have worked on developing a long-range capital plan that's designed to find the lowest cost solution to funding D.C.'s infrastructure gap. And really what they did is they took this 30-year look and they said, this is our current level of investment. And if we stay on this level of investment, here are the resources we're going to, you know, the infrastructure we'll take care of, the infrastructure we won't, and here's what we'll be 30 years from now. And then they said, what if we really boosted that level of investment to what we need to take care of the resource? So we talk about, you know, our shortfall here in the city of over $300 million. They said, well, what if we took care of a really large portion of that? What would that mean in the long run? Not surprising, it means that after 30 years, your assets are in significantly better condition, right? Instead of just sort of basically, you know, maintaining this bare minimum, they're in better condition. But the cost is also cheaper. And we know this. We know this from a transportation example, right, that if we take care of the streets now, and they were able to quantify that and show that the dollars invested now have a 5% return over that entire period of time in terms of that weighted return on investment for what they're making. And they also said, you know, they didn't necessarily want to address just the immediate funding gap, but really identify the solutions that would solve their problem over 30 years. This is the next step that Portland needs to take. We've done a lot of identification. We have a lot of information, but we need to take that next step to figure out what would investment now mean? What does a $50 million investment in Build Portland mean now when we look out 20 years from now? What would a $600 million investment mean? And how can we start moving in that direction? Step two, in addition to just finding the data, is to really do more action to identify and prioritize funding. We've done a lot, but there are more things we can do here. So one of the first things we note is how do we as a city plan for voter-approved bonds? I think it's fair to say that geo-bond funding is an absolutely essential part of the solution. And we've taken advantage of that. We have the Parks bond. If you go back, we've got public safety apparatus bond from a few years ago. And then we've seen other governments in the region do geo bonds as well. One of the problems we have is the competing interests, and those are competing interests both within the city and also among other governments in terms of these geo bonds. There is a price of government that Portlanders are willing to pay. It's relatively high compared to other governments, but at some point we will reach that limit. And we saw that the most recent school bond passed, but we saw a failure of a school bond a few years ago. And I think we want to make sure that we are strategizing carefully in terms of what comes to the ballot, when it comes to the ballot, and how large that request is, to make sure that we can use this as part of our strategy and that we don't get sideways with the taxpayers of Portland. And also that we don't get sideways with other governments, that we know what they're planning, they know what we're planning, and we can scale these things out into the future. So one of the recommendations that we're making here is that the city establish a coordinated bond planning process, you know, whereby a work group that involves council office executives, it involves OMF, the Bureau of Revenue Financial Services, the CAO, government relations, and other relevant parties within the city plan for what we need to do on geo bonds, and then start reaching out to other governments to figure out what they're doing as well. And again, I think a coordinated approach here is going to be essential to help solve this problem. A second solution is to increase our capital set-aside funding. We are dedicating 50% of one-time carryover funding in the fall bump and one-time resources identified in the budget process towards the capital set-aside. We could increase that. Again, this is a decision council could make at any time to bump that up to 70-75% or higher. And again, those resources have been really successful in solving some of our issues over the last few years, and I think can continue to be in the future. Identifying any opportunities we have for public-private partnerships. Public-private partnerships can be a little bit dicey sometimes, but there are opportunities here, and we can learn from other jurisdictions that have had both successes and failures in terms of what to do. But actually, PBOT is a bureau that has sought some of these dollars and has a proposal in terms of their traffic signal improvement needs and trying to see if they can leverage some private dollars to make some of those investments as well. And then finally, looking at ways to increase our ongoing general fund resources for major maintenance. And there are different strategies here. Most of the bureaus that have major maintenance, they have some funding for it, but it's not enough, and it doesn't allow them to keep up. Parks is a classic example of this. There are ways that we can just steadily start increasing those major maintenance funds so that the problem isn't getting any worse. We can do that through just planned current appropriation level increases to these budgets until we get to the recommended levels. We can also look at reallocating resources within those bureaus. As we discussed during the Parks budget session, one of the things that CBO is recommending is reductions within the Parks Bureau in order to increase their major maintenance funding. That can be very painful. But I think it's an honest assessment of what are the services we can afford today versus what are the things that we're going to end up paying for tomorrow. And then finally, step three after identifying and prioritizing is what do we need to do to make sure that the gap isn't going to grow? We need to make sure that we're growing our asset base responsibly. We need to make sure that we're not continuing to perpetuate our unfunding problem. Underfunding of infrastructure problem. And one of the things council could do here is adopt a life cycle costing policy for any new infrastructure. What life cycle costing means is it requires that all funds for ongoing maintenance and replacement of a new asset be allocated at the time the new asset is funded. What we currently do in the city is we look at operations and maintenance. And we look at that funding and say we need to make sure that operations and maintenance is included when a new asset comes online. But we don't look at the major maintenance and other long-term costs that are included with that asset. This is something that asset managers are capable of doing. It's something there's a lot of knowledge out there about, and it's something that council could require as we make these decisions for our bureaus that they take life cycle costing into account. And then, Mayor, getting back to your point about making sure that we have adequate reserves and replacement, I'll let Jennifer talk a little bit about some of the efforts there.
On Tuesday, April 3rd, I'll be convening an initial meeting to scope out what this general fund maintenance and equipment reserve policy might look like. There will be OMF staff there as well as folks from the bureaus, including fire, that brought this issue to the immediate attention. And I'll point out that OMF already has reserve policy and procedures for the internal service funds for facilities, fleet, technology, P&D, printing and distribution, that address equipment replacement and major maintenance, which may be a framework that we can start to build on. I expect that that we can bring this policy back to council by the end of the fiscal year.
So are you've mentioned numerous potential policies. I just want to make sure I understand what it is that you're bringing. Are you bringing all of these policies or some of these policies or just that policy? I'm not clear where you're headed with this.
You mean from the prior work session?
No,
from this one?
You have multiple steps here with multiple strategies. Are you planning to bring them back as a package or individually? What is your intention?
So we are happy to bring them back. Again, what we're trying to get here is a sense from council if this is the direction that they want to go. And to the extent we get that green light, yes, we will develop the policies and bring those back for council.
Okay, my suspicion is you're going to have to meet with the council offices individually and give them time to digest this. I'll certainly want time to digest it as well. There's some great ideas here. I love the life cycle costing policy. I'm curious, are we actually doing that with the Portland building?
The life cycle costs of the O&M are being built into that model, yes.
Very good. Because that's Exhibit A in terms of what happens when you don't have a life cycle costing policy. You wake up one day and find out you need to make a $300 million investment.
And I will raise touching on a point that Jennifer just made, that while we have policies on major maintenance reserves, there's a lot of debate about the level that we should be at, what percentage of the entire asset should be in major maintenance reserves. So our discussion needs to include that as well.
And also the enforcement of it. There's one thing about having a policy on the books, but then following that policy and not, quite frankly, weighting the reserves for other uses. So we can write the policy, but then we need to have some commitment to adhere to it.
Rob, did you have a question?
Yeah, just when it comes to the physical infrastructure piece of the condition assessment of assets, I'm wondering, you surely have a lengthy set of criteria that you use to make those assessments, and I just wanted to make sure that resilience of those physical assets, is seismic resilience in particular, is one of the things that is considered, because so many of the city's assets were built before there was any knowledge of the condition seismically of the region in which we live. Many of those assets don't reflect any of the current engineering or even engineering at the time because they didn't know. So I would hope that would be included as one of the things you're thinking about when you do the ad assessment.
Jesus. Any other questions on infrastructure before we move on to PERS? Okay. Go on to the next slide then. And I will turn it over to Jennifer.
PERS is a legacy liability, major liability for the city. In 1999, the city issued about $300 million of pension obligation bonds. And the idea was in 1999 to buy down the rate that we were paying to PERS for the unfunded liability that we had at that time. What I'm going to be talking with you about is a plan for managing the future PERS costs. According to the PERS actuaries, if the actual investment results are near assumption, which currently is 7.2% return on the PERS portfolio, there are forecasted increases in employer rates for the next two biennium to allow the plan to gradually recover to 100% funded by 2035. And we would expect to see, if the investment results match the assumption, that the rate of growth of the payroll rates after the 2023 would slow down as new OPSERP employees who have lower benefits will replace the retiring Tier 1, Tier 2 members. And then we would expect to see a significant rate drop after 2035 once a large portion of the current unfunded actuarial liability completes amortizing.
That means we all die off.
I'm sorry?
Meaning all the recipients die off. I like the way you said it better.
Thank you. The city issued $300 million of pension obligation bonds, as I mentioned. The bonds mature in fiscal year 28-29, and the final year's debt service in that year is $50.1 million. If $50 million were contributed to a side account in 2029, which is the mechanical way that member employers make additional contributions to PERS over and above their normal contribution rates, the projected cumulative reduction in contributions would be on the order of $90 million over a future 18-year period, which is basically saying that if you make an additional contribution today, you can buy down your future contribution rates. PERS offers an online Excel-based tool, which I used to generate the slide in front of you. This slide makes a lot of assumptions, such as investment rates are at the assumed rate of 7.2%. It assumes that $50 million is contributed today and not in 2029, because I can't rejigger the model to accommodate that. But what it is intended to show is that a $50 million one-time investment can bring down the the projected contributions that we're obligated to pay. But $50 million is not huge. It doesn't make a huge impact in those bar graphs, but it does show that there is an impact. So with the debt service that is currently in the budget all the way out through 2029, if we were to continue making those $50 million payments into PERS from that previously prior use of debt service, we could have a significant impact on our payroll rates going forward. So what council could do is give this me and the CFO and the CBO direction through a budget note to analyze what it would look like to plan for rededicating that $50 million towards PERS. Josh, is the CBO's budget forecast doesn't go out that far. It goes out for 5 years, so we would have to work to make some projections out beyond that five-year period. But since the debt service is already budgeted, it might be somewhat painless to continue to dedicate those funds for PERS either on a one-time basis or on an ongoing basis.
Commissioner Saltzman.
Is it considered poor form to consider issuing additional pension obligation bonds before the current ones have come due?
There was significant issuance of pension obligation bonds in the late 90s and in the early 2000s, and it's a gamble on what the return of those proceeds is going to give you relative to the debt cost itself. I think the city has been very fortunate so far in the performance of those bonds, particularly since half of them were issued on a variable rate, and we were able to ride down the general level of interest rates coming down over the last decade. I'm not sure I would say poor form, but financially, I wouldn't advise us issuing pension obligations bonds again.
Okay. And then wasn't there a new law passed that sort of sets up, encourages cities, counties to do exactly what you're talking about, setting aside a sort of a down payment that would benefit us in future years?
Yes, there was legislation passed in the short session that the governor supported, which facilitates member employers contributing over and above what they are normally billed for to a side account for PERS. There is a special attention given to the school districts and using excess monies to match what the schools are able to provide. The general framework for the governor's bill allows for a 25% match from the state for every dollar that a member employer makes into a side account. The state is still looking for ways to fund that match account, and then the use of that account is it's kind of like the worst funded member gets first dibs at that match. So according to the way that the prioritization works, the city would be lower down because we're not as in bad straits as some other member employers are. But 25% match does get your attention to take a look at it, which is why we started looking at this option going forward. But they have to find the $400 million to capitalize it, and then depending on how many other employers ask for a portion of it, I don't know what would be left for us to consider later on.
Could you tell us about the dynamics here between the 1921 cycle and the 21-23 cycle on one hand, where there's a precipitous jump, and then the 27-29 versus the 29-31, there's another precipitous jump. What's going on there?
So as best as I can understand this, when we issued pension obligation bonds, we took about $250-odd million and gave it to PERS to buy down our rates. And those monies have been amortized slowly each year, and the amortization of that will end at the end of the pension obligation bonds. So that would account for the jump between the 27-29 biennium and the 29-31 biennium. And then the decrease after 2035 is reflecting the overall a buy down of the UAL at the plan level because of the substitution of Tier 1, Tier 2 employees with a lot of the OPSERP employees.
And what would the current strategy be in the nearer term with regard to the jump between 2019 and 21 and 21-23?
Well, that that's already factored into the five-year forecast. So when the budget office prepares the five-year forecast, we have been assuming that the PERS rates will increase by the full collared amount for the entire period of the forecast.
It's a safe bet. So I think I inferred your answer, but it sounds like you're doing your analysis on the governor's proposed side account incentive, but it doesn't sound like you're particularly hopeful, A, because it's not funded, and B, because we'd be low on the list of priorities. But I still feel like we should do the analysis.
And we'll do the analysis. And the third part of that would be finding the funds to actually contribute over and above what we're already doing, given all the other needs that we previously talked about, such as infrastructure, et cetera. And I'd just like to put on the table that there are other legacy liabilities like Superfund and Columbia Levy, which are not directly reflected in this presentation, but are out there as well. We just don't have the dollar amounts to target to them.
There is that.
Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you.
To the next slide, which is going to be HR Director Summers McGee.
Mayor, Commissioners, thank you for allowing me to come to talk about human resources today, which is a discipline I love very much. So I'm going to walk you through the employer
Cyrilda,
of choice.
Cyrilda, can you state your name for the record?
Oh, I thought, okay. Cyrilda Thanks. Summers McGee, Bureau of Human Resources Director.
Thank you.
You're welcome. So what you have before you is an outline of the employer of choice buckets of work that we engage in. I'm going to focus on the current work that we're doing to move forward these initiatives and the future work we will be doing with managing staff costs being the focus of how I concentrate my thinking around this. So from strategic creativity, I'm going to focus on effective use of talent. Right now, BHR is receiving bids from NeoGov and SAP to roll out a new performance evaluation system that's online, that's goal-oriented, so that all employees in the city of Portland understands what success means for them at the start of a year, and then they are gauged and evaluated on whether or not they met those goals. So that is one of the areas where we're trying to effectively use our talent. In the future, what we're trying to do is engage with our partners in innovative solutions to their business challenges. So right now, we have bureaus who are coming to us and they're expressing that they're using a great deal of overtime. So they're coming to HR and they're saying, what are some possible solutions that we can deploy to reduce the amount of overtime that we're using? And we're having a great deal of success making suggestions to them of business challenges that they're up against. In the future, we hope to continue to do that work. Effective leadership. We're focusing here on training our business partners to essentially be able to support managers in administering high-quality, cutting-edge leadership best practices, right? So they're currently located inside each of our bureau ecosystems. When they see something, we want for them to have, whether it's conflict, whether it's disenchantment from staff, how to recognize it when they see it, and then how to disrupt the pattern before it becomes to a place, to a level where there's greater conflict or people are, spreading negativity inside the bureaus. So we're training up our business partners on best practices, ways to acknowledge and disrupt patterns that won't be healthy for business environments. In addition, in the future, what we plan to do is from an effective leadership standpoint, we also would like to, when it comes to collective bargaining agreements, because I put that into the bucket of effective leadership, to talk about collective bargaining agreements as an aggregate, not as a one-off, right? So that we can understand the implications of one agreement on future agreements in a particular bargaining cycle. And so in the future, we plan to continue to have these more comprehensive discussions with commissioners as well as with our bureau partners as they're beginning the negotiation process. Total rewards. The PTE 17 contract required the city to engage with the unions to evaluate the city's vacation accrual process. And that was our first time really joining forces proactively with our unions to talk about what do they think are best practices, what do we understand as best practices when it comes to vacation accruals. And it worked. We heard their perspective. They heard ours. I think everyone was satisfied with the way the process went forward. And we hope to be able to continue to engage in that kind of relationship with our union partners in the future. So kind of future forecasting, I think that that's a way for us to mitigate many of the conflicts that can come about when we don't join forces with them on the front end. Employee development and learning. I want to focus here on succession planning. Our recruitment team inside BHR has created new dashboards. We are now working with all of our utilities, and ultimately we want to work with every single bureau to come up with collective recruitment and advertising approaches that we think will help consolidate the cost. So right now, each bureau will oftentimes do their own one-off advertisement. Well, we can bundle those. And so those are some of the ways that we are trying to, number one, work with them to succession plan, but also save some costs for the city of Portland. And in the future, we hope to be able to launch a job shadow program, which it feeds into the employee development and learning standpoint. We have many employees throughout the city of Portland who are interested in learning about another department, division, or bureau. And so BHR thinks it's our responsibility to come up with some kind of a mechanism to allow employees to learn about other factions of the city of Portland. And it would be no additional expense to the city, theoretically, right? They would be able to take a bit of time off, shadow someone, and then go back into their daily work. No need to go to a training or a conference or things that oftentimes come with a big ticket or big amount of money. And then the final one is support inclusive work environments. Again, I refer here to our business partners because we are currently training our business partners on culturally responsive human resources best practices. So there are ways to do an investigation that are culturally responsive and culturally inclusive. Historically, we have not had the tools in our tool belt to be able to identify when one of our tactics perhaps isn't the most culturally responsive. So those are some of the ways that BHR is engaging in ensuring that we're an employer of choice and cutting costs when it comes to our personnel expenses. Questions?
Yeah. So the job shadowing that you were talking about, you're saying employees have interest in what's going on in another bureau?
They do.
Is that in relation to seeking employment in that other bureau?
Or perhaps. Just, yeah. And sometimes they're just interested in, I wonder what a planner does, or you know, people who have interest in one day having a career in human resources, but right now they're an engineer in water. It's really just an opportunity for people to explore what the other side looks like in a formal way.
Thank you. So this has been a very provocative conversation, Tom.
Can I make one point about follow-up,
sure.
Mr. Mayor, that I think
you
might
bet.
Be helpful? So it seems to me that we have a long list of potential policy changes with financial sustainability implications. Some of them come with trade-offs. I would make the suggestion that this team up here codify some of these in a memo for the commissioners and come up with kind of a follow-up strategy so that we can do the rounds and have some conversations individually with you to see where the direction is on numerous policies, since we put a lot on the table today. Would that make sense for the mayor and the commissioners to do that?
It would make perfect sense, and I was just going to suggest that. So if you and Andrew and Jennifer and Cyrilda could put your heads together and potentially bring some recommendations to the council, I'd appreciate that.
That's great.
Great. Thank you. So, colleagues, do you want to take a break or do you want to jump into the next? Okay, we'll take a quick break and we'll see you all right back here shortly. Is 5 minutes enough? 7 minutes. Commissioner Fritz is right. We have a scheduled break. We'll come back then at 11. Do you want to come back at 11:45? Commissioner Fritz, we're scheduled for a break till 11:45.
Yeah, well,
very good.
Not take quite that long, but 15 minutes would be nice.
15 minutes. Any disagreement? Hearing none. Done.